All right, I think we're going. Welcome everyone to a special edition of Legal Faceoff on WGN. Of course, we're dealing with the question of will Roe be overturned in the wake of the leaking of a draft Justice Alito decision late yesterday. We've got an all-star panel discussing this issue. First, and they're all repeat guests. Our co-host Tina Martini is unavailable, so we welcome Northern Illinois University College of Law Professor Mark Falkoff. He's a constitutional law professor, among other subjects. Professor, welcome back to Legal Faceoff.
Thanks, Rich.
We've got Andrew DeVoot from Loeb & Loeb. Andrew is also a past guest on Legal Faceoff and is a former federal prosecutor, Supreme Court law clerk, and currently is the co-chair of the White Collar Criminal Offense and Investigations Practice. Hello, Andy. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And Ashley Alvarez is, I want to get your title right, legislative counsel at Chicago City Council, the Committee on Economic, Capital, and Technology Development. Ashley, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back. Thank you, Rich.
And I think we're awaiting Professor Shapiro, who will be joining us shortly. Carolyn Shapiro, of course, frequent Legal Faceoff guest. From Chicago Kent College of Law. So she'll be joining us momentarily. But I want to get right into it and talk, of course, first about the leak, because to me, that's part, it's one of the really fascinating parts of this whole story. And Andy, I know you and I talked offline. First of all, we all could agree that this is unprecedented in the history of the Supreme Court. We have never seen a leak of a draft of a Supreme Court decision. There's certainly been rumors and perhaps leaks of who would be the majority or the minority, but never before have we seen an actual draft of a proposed Supreme Court decision leaked before it was published. The Supreme Court, of course, is famous for its secrecy. And in fact, clerks and all staff are sworn to secrecy. So Andy, having been a clerk in your case for former Chief Justice Rehnquist, tell us first about what you have to promise when you get that job. Certainly you take an oath of confidentiality, I assume, right?
Absolutely. You sign a number of forms, several to specifically, as I recall, you know, deal with that. And just the idea of that it is strictly enforced, you know, that you, you're dealing not only with cases that may be heard by the court, but then once they're heard, how they're going to be decided, you're looking at drafts, you're seeing the justices' thought processes. Depending on the chambers you're in, the justice will come back and share with you, the chief would come back and share with us his notes of what each justice was thinking and why they were voting the way they were voting. So we could have a sense of that in case we had to work on it. So I do think it is unprecedented. It's unbelievable. I was there in 2002, 2003, just a couple of years after the Bush v. Gore case. And you'll remember there was a Vanity Fair article where some of the clerks or some of the chambers, I think the language in an article I read, you know, spilled the beans, so to speak, of the process. And so much so that the chief put us all in a conference room shortly after we started, or I guess when they came back from summer break, and, you know, was polite but stern about our obligations and specifically referenced, you know, the last couple of years and just reminded everyone, you know, of the opportunity they had, but that the responsibility they had to maintain confidentiality.
Now, that's really interesting. Professor Falco, this is only a draft, right? This is not a final decision. The final decision on this Mississippi case is not expected to be released until June, the very earliest. So explain to our listeners and our viewers what the difference is between a draft of the decision and the actual Supreme Court decision.
Yeah, well, it's what you think. It's just a draft of an opinion. So it's not the final opinion. It can be changed. These things do change. I didn't clerk at the Supreme Court, but I clerked for a trial level federal judge and a federal appellate judge. And it's the same kind of thing. It's an early draft, which means it's subject to some rethinking when you're on a panel with other judges or on the Supreme Court. There's opportunity for some give and take. There's opportunity for some, as distasteful as it may seem to people, compromise. Roe v. Wade itself was a product, perhaps, I guess, ironically, of a lot of compromise and back and forth and tentative positions being staked out, different than what eventually emerged in the opinion. So the final product from the Supreme Court is what we are going to rely on as the law. So this really is just an unconscionable leak. I mean, it's fascinating. It's interesting. As a news person, you're interested in it. But this really undermines the deliberative process. And, you know, it's unfortunate. I guess I'll just say one more thing quickly. There might be an assumption that this was leaked by a liberal clerk or progressive clerk, which may well be the case, or a spouse of a clerk, who knows. But I wouldn't necessarily jump to that conclusion. It seems to me that once a draft of something is leaked, it becomes a little bit more difficult for the author, in this case, Justice Alito, to maybe back away from some of the positions that were initially staked out. I don't know. It's very confusing. It's very unfortunate.
Andy, undoubtedly you were involved in the drafting of these kind of documents. Tell us how many drafts typically go into a final decision, and is it common for the language? And we're going to talk very specifically about the language of this draft in a moment, because it's really interesting. But is it common for the language to change from the opening draft until the end? I mean, I know when I draft a brief, you know, sometimes the final product looks way different than the way it looked from the beginning. How is the process at the Supreme Court?
Sure. I think that, first of all, the number of drafts can really depend on the subject matter and the nature of the case. Right. There are some cases at the court that are more straightforward than others. But in a case like this, there's no question that there will be tweaks to language, passages, taking out certain things, no question. But, you know, I also think, given the nature of this case and given the way the court works and the clerks interact, and that a lot of communication went into back and forth amongst chambers before even this draft was put out. So, you know, only time will tell when we see what the final draft is like. But I think a lot of communication probably was put into this draft. So there will be changes. But, you know, when you think about who might have leaked this or not leaked this, going back to that, you know, I would find it shocking that it'd be someone from those five chambers, because they feel like they're so close to achieving their goal. It would be shocking to me to seem like they would do anything to upend the apple cart. So yes, things can change, but I think a lot of what you see here will be in that opinion. And you can see how it's already a lot of subsections. And I know Carolyn can speak to this too, that, you know, that's purposely set up. So if people want to join certain specific components, right, some of the history, the stare decisis discussion. So, and that's another thing, Rich, that there can be some reorganization or consolidating of sections depending on how the votes come in.
Thanks, Andy. Professor Shapiro, welcome. Frequent guest on Legal Face-Off. Professor Shapiro, as I mentioned, the Associate Dean for Academic Administration and Strategic Initiatives at Chicago Kent College of Law. She's also the founder and co-director of Chicago Kent's Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States. She has argued cases before the Supreme Court. She is a former Solicitor General of the state of Illinois. She's also a former Supreme Court clerk for Justice Breyer, the now retired Justice Breyer. Professor, almost. Almost right, officially not retired yet. Talk to us about this leak. We've talked about how unprecedented it is. Who do you think did it? I mean, have we narrowed it down to what, 36 possible candidates? The number of clerks that are currently working in the Supreme Court, or do you think it might be beyond that? I mean, is there a conspiracy here that goes beyond perhaps the immediate nexus of the clerks?
Well, you know, first of all, let's be clear. Anything that any of us say about who leaked it is pure speculation. My speculation, though, is that it was a strategic leak, and that it was a strategic leak that was done, if not by, then at the behest of a justice. And I see it differently than Andy. I see it more the way Mark does, that if it was it's the conservative, the far right, justices, and in particular, Justice Alito and Justice Thomas, who have wanted this result for decades, really don't want any of the other justices who they want to have join it to get cold feet. And the way they would get cold feet, to be clear, is not to decide to strike down this Mississippi law that's at issue, which outlaws abortion after 15 weeks. That law is going to be upheld no matter what. They would get cold feet by deciding not to go as far as this opinion goes, which is to completely overrule Roe versus Wade.
Well, here's my theory, and I also think that it's a strategic link, and Ashley could weigh in on this also, but my theory is that this is a trial balloon. And actually, if you look at the Trump presidency, a lot of it has its roots in that, because Trump would famously float a trial balloon about the most extreme position. And then when he gauged public reaction, we all know that Trump vociferously followed polls and public reaction, he would then take position that was less than that. So to me, this is strategic in putting out the most extreme possible position in the most extreme possible language, and then actually coming up with a plan, with a decision that, in when you compare it to this extreme position, seems more palatable to the American public. What do you all think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I actually did think that this might have been even campaign related, because we are in the beginning of midterms and we're starting to see that open up. And I wonder if this would maybe be a motivating factor, because we are a little concerned about a red wave right now. I've seen it all in this space. So really, it is speculation. Yeah. I mean, it's either an upset staffer or it's an election pusher to get out the vote.
Professor Falkoff, I mean, it's a little bit of a, you know, political question, but when, you know, when the Mississippi case, when the Texas case first came down, many people were outraged, right? How could they limit abortion to this new standard? Well, when you compare that to this decision, I think a lot of people would be happy if those other cases were the law of the land instead of this Alito decision.
Well, yeah, I mean, this, if this opinion or something like it becomes law, then Roe is dead. So anything less than that would seem like a victory at this point. I mean, I don't know. It sounds like we've narrowed it now down to 9 justices. I think maybe Justice Breyer in the robing room with a monkey wrench. I mean, it's just so hard to know. It'll be fascinating to find out what actually happened.
Yeah. Let's turn to the language, because I think the language of this at least draft is really fascinating. Professor Shapiro, when I first got the text from, you know, lots of people last night, my first reaction was, this is a hoax, because there's no way that any sitting justice would write a decision with this kind of verbiage. It's unprecedented, in my opinion. And of course, you're all better experts than I am, but the direct attack on a Supreme Court precedent, and not just any precedent, but one that is the most well-known precedent, arguably in American history, in the top 5, for a sitting justice to attack it that way, to me seemed like impossible. It seemed like it was made up. But what do you make, Professor Shapiro, of the language that at least this early draft has in attacking directly Roe v. Wade and also Casey?
Doesn't surprise me at all. I think those cases have been the prime target of the conservative legal movement for decades. And they think that they are utterly intellectually bankrupt. So which I do not agree with that, to be clear, at all. But I think that's the framework that Justice Alito is operating from. And Justice Alito is not really known for being particularly restrained about his feelings. I mean, he often complains about things that he thinks are somehow, you know, unfair, and he specifically does that around abortion. His opinion in Whole Women's Health, for example, complains about the procedural aspects of that case at great length. And so, you know, the grievance of this opinion, or the aggrieved tone of this opinion, really doesn't surprise me at all.
And when a justice writes a decision, I mean, this is stuff that we would never know, and uses words like, in this draft, Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. Its reasoning was exceptionally weak, and the decision has had damaging consequences. When a justice uses words like that, very inflammatory words, are those the actual justice's words, or are those the product of, a collective decision of the majority, or is it more the language of the clerks? I mean, how does that work? I guess it depends on the case, but in this case, and to Justice or to Professor Shapiro's point, perhaps one day Justice Shapiro, but Professor Shapiro's point, is this actually the way Alito talks about Roe v. Wade?
Right. So I every justice is different and every chambers is different, but I would never, in my experience and the work I did with the chief, those were words he would add in his tone. He would decide in the ultimate tone. I might put something in there, but I don't think I would feel that I had, I mean, it's not my name on the wall, right? I wasn't appointed by the president. My role there was try to capture what the chiefs said, the majority said, or whomever I was writing draft for. And those, in my opinion, are the types of things that he would personally address. And I just want to say a couple
to that point. Let me break in because that's a really interesting point. And then Professor Shapiro, jump into. So do you almost, I mean, if you're clerking for Justice Alito, certainly you're of a certain political bent, right? Certainly you believe in generally pretty conservative values. So Professor Shapiro, Andy, do you start off with the most conservative, strident language and then work backwards from there? In other words, trying to, you know, prove your point in the most, aggressive language, or do you write the way you think the decision will actually come out?
It really depends on the chambers, and it even also depends on the law clerk. You know, when I was clerking, there were law clerks who tended to write even bench cert memos, which circulate to the entire court, with a kind of tendentious tone. That was really, in my view, not appropriate, and that view is shared by, I think, most of the law clerks. But I would imagine that law clerks who would do the same when they're writing a draft opinion for their own justice. And whether that individual justice thinks that that's okay or not, they will certainly communicate that to their law clerks. So I just don't think it's possible to generalize.
Right. In respect to the language, or go ahead, Mark. So good.
I just want to make one point about that language that you quoted, Rich, because you read that in the first time through the opinion. That occurs relatively early in the opinion. It is pretty striking. There's no doubt about it. And I have yellow highlighting all over that, just like you do, probably. It's interesting, though, that when you get near the back end of the opinion and you see the longer discussion of stare decisis, you realize that what Alito does here is he lays out five considerations for when stare decisis should or should not be respected, or how you would analyze stare decisis. And if you go back, you'll see that everything that you just said in that paragraph, all of that vitriolic language, it is pegged directly to one of those five stare decisis considerations. So it's not just vitriol. It's an integral, I would say, an integral part of his analysis, which I think is pretty interesting.
And Rich, I want to talk about stare decisis. Yeah,
Just one thing on the language, though. There are a couple of things in there that I hope gets left in the cutting room floor, and that's the reference to Justice Ginsburg's opinion in Timms versus Indiana. You know, this is under the idea of Washington versus Glucksberg, and when you're going to look about, you know, what it is in terms of constitutional rights. And, you know, it's one thing when a justice is at the court and they're, you know, they love to quote back to each other, well, you said this in that case, right? And when a justice is, you know, on the court and alive. But I think my personal opinion, to have that language about her exploration of the Eighth Amendment right is borderline disrespectful. And I think even Justice Scalia, if he were on the court and that, you know, for his colleague, if she were no longer on the court and she had passed, I really think that's a bridge too far. I also, the language in here, the examples, the stare decisis discussion is interesting, but to use the examples that he uses, the nature of the court's error, to use Plessy, and then when you get into the discussion about important decisions have overruled prior precedents, to use Brown versus Board, to use decisions about women's rights, I just think that's a poke in the eye, an unnecessary poke in the eye to a lot of people in an already controversial opinion. And I understand that it probably feels really good in chambers and sounds clever, but man, it just seems like an unnecessary poke in the eye in this discussion.
That's going to stay. I would bet a lot of money that part stays.
It was the same points were made during oral argument too. Exactly the same points.
Let's jump into that, because stare decisis is such an interesting part of this discussion. It seems like that is something that's fungible, right? That every justice who has signed on seemingly to this draft, we don't know what the final decision is going to be, but the five justices who are seemingly in the majority in their confirmation hearings, each of them were asked about Roe v. Wade and other super precedents, for lack of a better term. And to a person, they all gave a form of the same answer, that there are some Supreme Court decisions that are precedent upon precedent. And while they would not all commit to not overturning these cases, they all committed to the idea that the more cases are relied upon for a long period of time, they become almost untouchable. Yet here, we see that Justice Alito is saying, on behalf of the majority, unquestionably, that doesn't matter. We can overturn precedent. So where does that leave the concept, Professor Falkup, of stare decisis? How are we supposed to rely as a society on any decisions that the highest court in the land makes?
Well, I mean, this is a fascinating discussion to have. It really is. First of all, the super precedent that they're talking about is Casey rather than Roe, because Casey was a case right. in which you had the three concurring justices basically say, well, stare decisis is important, so we're going to leave Roe where it is. But, you know, exactly, what is stare decisis? I mean, this is a question for philosophers and law professors, and then, you know, justices working it out. I think it's very interesting to have an opinion where you have the justices try to work out what are the meets and bounds of stare decisis. It's always going to be contested. It's a fascinating intellectual exercise. It's incredibly frustrating for those of us who believe in a woman's right to choose and so forth to see it played out in this manner here. I don't find it a particularly, frankly, a compelling discussion. I know most people will not have read, you know, this draft decision at this point, but we've got 5 points that are laid out by Justice Alito. And, you know, frankly, none of them are knocked down, dead bang winner. I mean, they simply show that, you know, this is a contested kind of issue. So I don't know. I'm just not. I don't buy it entirely. I'm fascinated that it's there, but I can't buy it.
Professor Spirito Sterry, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think part of what happened at the confirmation hearings, it's not just that the nominees talked about Roe and Casey as precedent, or in the case of Casey, precedent on precedent. They also talked about the way they judge as a kind of neutral, kind logically, logical deduction, that that there's a right answer, and if they just gaze long enough at the materials, that right answer will emerge. And that idea is completely wrong when it comes to the work of the Supreme Court. And this opinion illustrates exactly why. Everything that Justice Alito says in this opinion is contested. It is not logically deducible that stare decisis in this case shouldn't hold. That's a matter of discretion and ideology. And so, to my mind, it's the combination of those two things that's been most problematic at confirmation hearings. This claim that, yes, of course it's precedent. Well, yeah, but that doesn't tell us what you're going to do with it. And then alongside that, this claim that I just apply the law, I don't make the law, which is simply a poor description of what happens at the Supreme Court at best.
All right, I want to talk about some practical impacts of this decision, if it is a decision. Ashley, let's get you in on this issue, because you're involved in some of the practical effects of this. I know that you just recently drafted a resolution for the City Council of Chicago in an attempt to protect the rights of women to terminate their pregnancy. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're very fortunate to be in Illinois, in a state that, regardless of what holding is, you know, and the outcome may be, we are protected. This is written into our Illinois state constitution, and we don't have to worry about that. But I think we also need to look at what funding mechanisms we can start reaching out to and what support systems look like, so that other nearby states, because every state around us is not going to have those protections if they overturn Roe v. Wade. I mean, if that happens, this case ends up falling in that direction, we need to look at how we're going to start protecting everybody that's going to start coming in. And so I think it's really important right now, as we're at a local level, because every form of government is really impactful, especially a local level, since we seem to have a lot of federal insecurity, to make sure that we are getting those support systems in place and that we are in opposition and really holding up our elected officials that have, you know, promised to be in support of our unenumerated rights.
Well, it's interesting. Talk about the language to that point. Talk about the language earlier. In some ways, the way Alito wrote this draft, if he did write it, if this is a draft, which we think it's been confirmed already, it's interesting that this might actually turn out to have a motivating factor for Democrats and for liberals, because it's not just a case where, you know, abortion rights are being chipped away slowly. This is a full-throated, vocal repudiation of Roe v. Wade, which ironically, may turn out to have a motivating impact on voters to come out and vote for Democrats in the upcoming congressional elections, which may serve to generate a federal law protecting a woman's right to choose. We already heard from President Biden earlier today calling for that. We've heard from most congressional leaders already. So, Ashley, what about that? Do you think that if the leaker, if the breacher was in fact a right-wing clerk trying to pressure the five justices into this decision, perhaps it will have the opposite effect long-term?
I mean, this is historically what we've seen when when the decision came out about the news with Hillary Clinton and we found out that she was not going to be our first woman president, we saw the women's march come out in numbers that we've never seen before. And that's when our blue wave came. So I think that, yeah, these things definitely play a really big factor and impact on it. Still not sure who the leaker was, but I do think that this will ultimately say a lot about what comes next. And we have the ability right now. I think I really liked what somebody had said, and I'm forgetting her name, but she had said that we don't even need to wait for elections. Everybody who is writing letters and emails about fundraising right now, stop and codify this, because we can. We have the opportunity for people that are not in office or that are in office and have that power to do so. And we don't need to wait for the Supreme Court to step in. And I think that's also something important to keep in mind when we're holding our elected officials accountable.
Andy, one thing we could all agree on that Justice Alito wrote in this draft is that the word abortion is not written in the Constitution. That's unequivocal. Many in the wake of this news in the last 20 or so hours have speculated that if the Supreme Court could overturn Roe and Casey, what's next? Can they eliminate other rights that are under the umbrella or penumbra of the right of privacy, like the right to interracial marriage, the right to same-sex marriage, etc.? Now, is that just sort of people getting a little ahead of themselves, or do you think there's a real risk to other rights that have been accepted over the last few decades?
I mean, it's a lawyer's answer, but we'll have to see. It is interesting when you read it three or four times, if you count Mark with the highlighter like you, where they try, it seems like he tries to really say, but this is different because of fetal life, because there's three or four, I think, at least instances where he tries to reference that this is different than marriage. This is different, even though there's that, suggesting that the argument is going to lead to legalization of drug use and prostitution in another section. But I think they're trying to send the message that it's not going to lead to that, that this is very specific because of, because we're talking about life.
Professor Falkoff, Professor Barrow, what do you think of that? Do you think other rights, if this does, in fact, overturn Casey and Roe to the degree that this draft is written, what's next? What's in the future for rights that we all enjoy right now?
Well, I'll just say quickly, I mean, I agree with Andy that Alito went to pains in this draft to try to distinguish the abortion context from other contexts like, interracial marriage is in there. There's a whole list of holdings in there where the Supreme Court has recognized rights that the language cannot be found in the Constitution, penumbras and the due process clause and so forth. So there's an attempt to distinguish that, but I don't find it very convincing. It's not robust at all. I mean, it's little more than simply a statement. Well, this is different. This is life. I would be particularly concerned about Obergefell and Windsor and, the gay marriage kinds of cases. I think that's definitely ripe for revisiting. Of course, if you take a kind of a political realist view of what the court does, it seems much less likely at this point in time that they would roll back those particular holdings in contrast to abortion, which, has fueled a movement for a long time. But I think, as a logical matter, those are the kinds of things I'd be very concerned about.
And I agree with that and would add certain forms of contraception. There's, say IUDs, certain forms of the pill that prevent implantation. It's really hard for me to see why a state, if this opinion becomes the law of the land, it's hard for me to see why a state wouldn't be able to outlaw those forms of contraception as well.
Ashley, what's the early response you're getting from City of Chicago Alder people? You heard from the governor very early. I imagine at this point, Lori Lightfoot has released a statement. I haven't seen one, but I imagine that the Alder person that you work for, Gilbert Villegas, is very much against this decision, as are the majority of the city council.
Yeah, no, I think everyone's really been, you know, joining to co-sponsor the resolution that we've introduced. I think everyone's trying to find different avenues. I also think everyone didn't know what to kind of do. And not everybody was staying up all night yesterday reading the opinion, like I'm sure all we were. So I think we're just trying to find our bearings still a little bit. It's a very stark reality, especially for women who have weakened power as it is. So we're really disempowered in this moment. It is an uncomfortable feeling.
Yeah, I mean, that's for sure. You know, one person, one analyst said it very aptly today that women this morning are waking up for the first time in 50 years with less rights than they did a day ago. Less rights than their predecessors have. They got to tell their daughters that they will have less rights than they've enjoyed over the last 50 or so years, which is really, to your point, hard to get your head around at this point. But I want to end off with, you know, a little insight into the Supreme Court, as I always try to do when I have the privilege of having former Supreme Court clerks on our program. You know, at the end of the day, you know, the nine justices on the Supreme Court, when we all hold them in such high regard, appropriately so, I've always been fascinated with the whole mystique of the nine. At the end of the day, they are just men and women, right, who have got to go home and they've got to answer to people. And they, you know, undoubtedly, while they try to avoid social media, I'm sure they're not totally immune to it. And they've got children and grandchildren. What's the pressure there? I mean, are they so above it all, Andy and Professor Shapiro, that they're really not truly affected by this outswell of public outrage that we've seen for the most part? Now, certainly among a large part of the population, this decision will be celebrated, right? So perhaps, you know, that's the answer. But as just people, I know you got to know during your course of work there, you got to know each of the individuals pretty well. How are they affected by outside forces? I mean, how, if this decision really comes down the way it's drafted and there is outrage by a large segment of the population, how will Justice Alito deal with that? Or will he be unaffected by it? I mean, what will he tell his grandchildren who are, you know, seeing all sorts of social media outrage about it? What are your thoughts on that, Andy, first?
Sure. I mean, for me, I think about the Chief Justice. That's the one I think about. You know, there's been 46 presidents in this country, 17 Chief Justices in 1789. And when you become Chief Justice, your role is different. It is different. You saw it with Rehnquist, Chief Justice Rehnquist, if you look at opinions, and you are the shepherd of that flock and you're the defender of that institution. And it is bigger than yourself or your personal opinions, in my opinion. And I think about him both with the leak and this opinion, and I think it's got to be gut-wrenching. I think there's no other way to put it. He clerked for a chief himself. You know, we can disagree or agree with his ideology or his views or whatever, but he's still, you know, he is the Chief Justice, the leader of this institution. That's what I've been thinking about the last since we heard about this, just both these points, both the draft opinion, what it may do, and the leak itself. I just think for him, this has to be absolutely gut-wrenching.
Yeah, well, I certainly agree with that. And I don't think Justice Alito is likely to be much affected at all by what is being said about him. First of all, there's plenty of media out there and social media that is going to be supportive of this. And my suspicion is that that's, to the extent he reads any of it, that's what he's exposed to. To the extent he's exposed to the critical stuff, I think he's going to be proud of himself for standing up to the political pressure of the hegemonic left.
We'll give the last word to Professor Falkoff to those points. What do you think? I mean, we already saw the statement from Chief Justice Roberts earlier today in which he expresses outrage at this breach of security and ordered the marshal to investigate it. But, you know, he's concerned with his legacy. We have heard from him before, for example, when President Trump talked about there being Obama justices. We heard the Chief Justice come out loudly against that. What do you think his reaction is today beyond what we've already read from his statement?
Well, I think his statement made it pretty clear. I mean, it's outrageous. I mean, the Chief Justice is an institutionalist, and I mean, he spent a lot of time protecting the integrity of the court. Yeah, I mean, that this is, this undermines it. And then, you know, then there's the, it's going to be interesting to see where he comes out on the opinion and on the stare decisis kinds of issues. And that's probably more important than the leak itself. I mean, the leak is egregious and everyone recognizes that. What does it mean to sign on to or not on to or onto part of the decision that ultimately gets issued? I think that's going to be really the really interesting question.
Professor Mark Falkoff, Andy DeVote, Ashley Alvarez, Professor Carolyn Shapiro, thank you all very much for joining us on this really interesting day. We'll be sure to keep following this issue on Legal Faceoff. We'll be taping our actual, our next full podcast this Friday. Be dealing with this in more detail, and appreciate all of your insight and welcome you back to Legal Faceoff in the future.
Thanks for having us.
See everyone. Take care.